I don't pay attention to rumors. I don't pay attention to movie magazines. They don't read them because they're all junk. And I don't mean to put anybody's job down. I'm talking about they have a job to do, and they got to write something. So if they don't know anything, they make it up, you know. So in my case, they make it up. When I hear rumors flying around, I got sick in the hospital. Well, I was, you know, in this day and time, you can't even get sick. You are strung out. Oh, by God, I'll tell you something, friend. I have never been strung out in my life, except on music. When I got sick here in the hotel, I got sick here that one night. I had 102 temperature. They wouldn't let me perform. From three different sources, I heard I was strung out on heroin. I swear to God, hotel employees, Jack, bellboys, freaks that carry your luggage up to the room, people working around, you know, talking, maids. And I was sick. I was, you know, I was getting, had a doctor, had the flu, and I got over one day. But all across this town, I was strung out. So I told him earlier, and don't you get offended, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking to somebody else. If I find or hear the individual that has said that about me, I'm going to break your goddamn neck, you son of a bitch. That is dangerous. That is damaging to myself, to my little daughter, to my father, to my friends, my doctor, to everybody, my relationship with you, my relationship with up here on the stage. It is dangerous. I will pull your goddamn tongue out by the roots. Thank you very much.
Recorded live in the USA and covering the whole wide world, this is the Bob and
To Be Determined
Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and
insert name here.
Well, nobody's gonna go out with me.
Have you asked anybody yet?
No, but who would? I don't even have any good skills.
What do you mean?
You know, like nunchuck skills, bow hunting skills, computer hacking skills. Girls only want boyfriends who have great skills.
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality. Yeah. The Bob and
insert name here
show.
Yeah, lots to talk about this week. Yeah, I decided because Elvis is no longer on the show, I wanted to keep Buzz's bumpers on the show. So Buzz, deep voice guy there, is still on the show. What I wanted to do is take out the mentions of Elvis in there so I could preserve the rest of it until I have Buzz create a new one. So that's my awkward remix of the initial open for the show, as well as the disclaimer and all that crap. And, of course, at the top there was the real-life Elvis Presley. Very clearly strung out on a variety of things, but denying the fact that he was strung out. It's easily my favorite clip of fat, bloated, you know, Elvis, latter-day Elvis. It was really like an actual press conference. I believe it was in Las Vegas sometime in the early 70s. You know, the fat Elvis with the saran wrap girdle, who would eat, you know, a peanut butter and banana sandwich with a pound of bacon and a hollowed out loaf of bread, 5 hot fudge sundaes for breakfast, pass out 10 o'clock in the morning. And then the Memphis Mafia would put him in a big diaper made of sheets, like the bed sheets from the hotel. And then they'd have to clandestinely go down and dispose of them in the dumpster. I love that crap. So, hence that clip at the top of the show. But anyway, as I said, no more Elvis. You're just joining the show if you're listening to the show for the first time, you'll notice that it's not the Bob and Elvis show anymore. We literally don't have a title for the show. There's no title for the show, but it is, of course, sponsored by Bubble Genius, Pure Products, Pure Genius. Bubble Genius at www.bubblegenius.com. And what I'd like to do until I get a regular co-host to replace Elvis Dingledean, I'd like to bring in just, you know, special guest co-hosts who will, you know, sort of sit in on the show. I kind of liken it to, you know, the old classic Tonight Show, where just like Bob Hope would wander onto the set, strung out, very obviously. They're all drunk. They're all drunk on that show. And they would just wander on and sit down and talk to Johnny. Not comparing myself to Johnny, but, you know, that's the kind of, I always like that kind of idea where anything can happen. Like, anyone would show up on the show. And so they go, wow, oh, my God, I had no idea that, you know, Dean Martin was going to wander on drunk. And so that's, the, you know, I figure we'll do that for a little bit until I make up my mind as to who will replace. So last week there was Ches Pazienza was on the show. And then I think next week will be Shannon Moore. Shannon Moore from Alaska. Shannon Moore, who is like the arch nemesis of Sarah Palin. I can't wait for that. And then maybe down the road, Steven Weber. That'll be fun. But this week is from one of the best shows ever to be on the television. In fact, every Saturday morning, if you follow the blog, every Saturday morning, I run a clip of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Because it is... legally or not, all over YouTube. I mean, every Saturday since I started the blog, I really started the blog in earnest every day in mid to late 2007. And every Saturday since then, I've been able to find a clip from Mystery Science Theater, which, you know, I like to run that on Saturday because that's when I really started to watch the actual show when it was on. It was on every Saturday morning. It was either on Comedy Central there for a while, and then eventually Sci-Fi. And so when I started writing on Twitter and tweeting and getting involved in all of that, soon I noticed, well, I get this, someone starts following me named Bill Corbett. I said, oh, I recognize that name, Bill Corbett. So I said, oh, this is cool. I got to go find out who Bill Corbett is. And it turns out that it's the Bill Corbett from Mystery Science Theater 3000. I was like, oh, my God. So his eyes bug out of my head. And I go, well, this is great. I wonder why the hell he would want to follow me. So nevertheless, on the show today, sitting in on the show, wandering on, hopefully not drunk or strung out, is Bill Corbett. How you doing, Bill?
Hi, Bob. Very, very strung out.
Strung out.
Strung out.
You're going to rip your tongue out by the roots.
Wow, he must have been really at like the 11th hour right about then.
Yeah,
that was deeply addled, Elvis.
Yeah, that was sort of I've got over the years I've sort of collected Elvis like rumors and urban myths about Elvis. You know, he had that kit that he would haul around with him, like Hamburger James of his entourage would haul this this cigar box with all kinds of stuff in there, like there was a pistol in there and a pack of Freedom and gum and various uppers and downers. And
I love how specific that is, the very brand of gum.
Yeah, well, there was a specific number, like a number of items that had to be in that kit at all times. And
I see.
And there was like a wad of cash in there, and the laxatives and various things too.
That I can believe about Latter-day Elvis.
I'm not sure. Yeah, right. And I'm not sure how much food was in there, but the guy could down his food. And I always think of those, you know, I think, maybe 20 years ago or something like that, Elvis's chef released a book of all of the stuff that Elvis would eat. And it's no wonder that, you know, there's another rumor that he died. And when they did the autopsy, his colon weighed 40 pounds.
That one I do know. There's a similar one about John Wayne, is there not, that he had a big impacted, I don't know how else to say it, but poopy in him. You know,
right.
Weighed about half the size of an average man.
Yeah, and it was the one I heard about Elvis. And this is really, really gross. So if you're listening to this show while you're eating, you might want to fast
stop.
Forward to this. Yeah, please just stop eating and listen to the show, goddammit. The show, his colon was weighed 40 pounds, and it was made up of impacted white chalky material.
Yeah! We're getting the rough stuff out of the way right off the bat here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're separating the true listeners.
Inoculating people.
From the tourists, right? We're getting getting rid of all the tourists on the show. They said, well, you know what? I'm not going to listen to Bob and Bill talk about Elvis's 40-pound impacted colon for an hour.
Yep. So. Just a whole hour of impacted colon stuff.
But nevertheless, I mean, you know, I was talking a second ago about sort of how we met up on Twitter, and I really appreciate you agreeing to come on the show. I mean, I'd watched Mystery Science Theater for years and years and years. You were a writer on that show for how long?
It was kind of weird. I was on for a couple of years, and then they got canceled, so I went off to Hollywood. And then, you know, while I was wandering around there homeless for a while, I got a call that, not literally, but I got a call that they had picked it up on the Sci-Fi Channel and to come back and, you know, write for the puppets again.
Oh, great.
So I'd say there was about half. I only wrote on about half a season. Mm-hmm. Then they did a short season that was kind of minimized and budget constrained, which was their last season on Comedy Central, I believe. And then it was off the grid for a while, and then it got rebooted by Sci-Fi, and that's when I started doing the puppet.
Yeah, yeah. Then you were Crow T Robot for what, mm-hmm. the last three seasons?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the one thing that I've always wondered, and I never had a chance really to investigate and read about it, because I'm sure there's lots of answers online. You guys would control those puppets as you were actually delivering the lines, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It was completely analog.
God, I mean, how do you, and was it, I mean, this is just really sort of geeky basement of the science building kind of questions that are probably better reserved for like a DVD bonus feature. But so you would actually sit there with it. Was it like, you know, the old Muppets where the Jim Henson and Frank Oz would have to have their arms lifted up like straight up in the air for an hour and a half? Or was it would you sit down below? And
it was actually pretty well designed. I don't, if you remember the set, there was that desk that Joel Hodgson and then later Mike Nelson sat in back of, or
yeah.
stood in back of. And right on either side of him, there were two trenches where, you know, kind of up to an average person's waist that myself and Kevin Murphy, who played Tom Servo, just climbed down into them and then, you know, kind of leaned the puppets up against the desk there.
Yeah.
So it really wasn't that, grueling, not like Jim Henson. It only got grueling when they did slightly more complicated cinematography, which our DP, who is really great guy, but he just was getting a little bored, I think, and he wanted more interesting shots. So every now and then they would have Crow wandering around, you know, without that precious desk to lean him against. That's when I started to, you know, the blood started to pool in my elbow.
And
but,
so,
yeah, I mean, it wasn't that grueling physically. It was more just, you know, mental acuity,
yeah,
or lack thereof.
And how much of that was, I mean, you know, there was the stuff that was actually in the ship that you were just talking about, where you'd be standing in a trench, and then there's the movie. I mean, how much of each was improvised versus actually scripted?
It was almost totally scripted, which, you know, I feel a little sheepish about sometimes, because I know that improv is a, you know, a much lauded skill, and rightly so. But the show started out with just, you know, a bunch of guys doing it improv. And I think more and more people realize, well, if we really want to do this right, we should try to write it artfully, and, you know, do it where there's spaces for jokes, mm-hmm. instead of just running over the cues. Every now and then we've been on radio shows, or we used to go on radio shows, and people would say, here's something, you know, to do, like, just riff this for us. Would you, man, just riff this thing? And they were always disappointed at what knobs we were. I mean, just, right. You know, get off a good joke, one out of every four, maybe, but for the most part, we wrote it pretty meticulously.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about, I think, from what I know about improv, especially when it comes to doing films or TV, it's gets a little sketchy. I mean, it gets a little, I mean, there's lots of potential to screw it up. And so, you know, for example, on The Office, on the original UK Office, and I'm sure the American version, which I don't always watch, but the original Ricky Gervais version,
right.
of The Office, it feels improvised, but they were, extraordinarily meticulous about scripting every line and kind of sticking with that script. Because, you know, they wanted to make sure that it was funny, first and foremost, rather than the more artistic almost art fart approach of saying, well, we're improvised and we're purist and everything that happens spontaneously. And so it was that, you know, I guess it was all, there was just no way to improvise something like an hour and a half or a 2 hour film.
I mean, you could. It wouldn't have been as funny. It would have been a lot more hit and miss. There might have been some surprises. There might have been like an adventure for everybody, knowing that none of this was written down. I mean, there are virtues to it. But there are kind of meaningless distinctions after a while. Like Spinal Tap, which I'm sure you know, was just, you know, mostly done improv, but they edited the hell out of it. Like they had hundreds of hours of film. Maybe not hundreds, but they certainly had a lot that, you know, that was not used because it wasn't very good, simply. If you look on DVD extras of Spinal Tap, they have a couple of scenes there that you go, wow. I mean, you could see that might have gone into the film, but I'm really glad it didn't. It's a weird scene where Bruno Kirby plays their limo driver in one scene, and they have him back at the hotel, and they have him like in his underwear, and they're kind of taunting him, and he's like defending Sinatra to them, and it's like uglier than the rest of the material in Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
So they did some good editing. So whether you write it, you know, kind of as you go, or you know, you actually put it on paper, it doesn't mean that much to me ultimately.
So when you were writing the show, then is it something that you would sit in a room with the other writers and kind of watch the movie or the short spontaneously and kind of throw in jokes as you went along? Or was it a more meticulous process where everyone would sort of take the movie home and kind of go over it and bring jokes to the table and say, well,
thing you described. It was, we had a writer's room where we would just watch the movie and stop it periodically. And some poor schmuck would have to type it all down as we went. And we took turns doing that. And from there, you know, with all these time-coded jokes or comments or grunts or fart noises, we would, split into a team of three, and I was one of the three people who would, like, write the actual script for the movie, and then we'd winnow it from there and change it. So it really kind of started as improv, sort of recorded improv, and then from there was winnowed down to the best of that. But what we do now, myself and Mike Nelson and Kevin Murphy, this thing called Riff Tracks,
yes.
We actually do the second thing you described. More, we take it home, and you know, we split it into five, us three, and then the two writers we have, and kind of just write a chunk, and from there we get a little more loose. So,
yeah,
it kind of works either way.
And so, and in the process of, and just going, I want to get to Riff Tracks in a second, but going back to Mystery Science Theater, when you were writing, would you write for specific characters? I mean, was it that refined where you said, well, this is a joke that would be better for Crow, or this is a joke would be better for Tom Servo or Mike or prior to him, Joel?
Not as much as you would think. I mean, I think there are certain things that you would default to, like Kevin Murphy is a really great singer. So when there was something musical, I would tend to give it to him. Mike Nelson has a really great dry delivery. So if there was a subtle thing that needed that, I would tend to give it to him. But mostly it was interchangeable.
Yeah, now, so you mentioned Riff Tracks a second ago, and it's not anything I'd seen before. You guys actually will record an audio track, Mystery Science Theater style, where you're making jokes and commenting on a film, but it's sort of a first-run movie. It's a more recent film that everyone has seen, perhaps, and there's an actual process in which the listener has to synchronize the audio with the DVD. Now, how does that... Was that something that you guys just the three of you came up with and decided to put together? I mean, how did that all come together?
Yeah, well, towards the end of our run of Mystery Science Theater, we were doing these specials every now and then, these Oscar specials or summer blockbuster specials, which were shorter shows where we would just like take the clips of, you know, the contenders for the Oscars or the big, like the EPK, the electronic press kit of the movies coming up, and just like riff little bits of them. And, if, you know, the obvious reason we couldn't do them is just the rights. We couldn't grab Titanic, for example, and do that. And people were always saying, you should just do the whole movie, man. And it's just like, well, we can't. We have to buy it. And, you know, we buy it from people who are big enough to crush us like bugs. So, you know, when Mystery Science Theater was over and we were still working together on other stuff, Kevin Murphy had this idea of just doing MP3 commentary that, you know, are totally divorced from the rights and having people sync it together. Excuse me. And then Mike Nelson went to work for a company called Legend Films in San Diego and presented that to them, and they kind of bit. So we've done a shit ton of movies now. We also do those old shorts we used to do on Mystery Science Theater. They're more, you know, public domain things that you can just download the entirety of it. You don't have to sync it up.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And some old, like, public domain films, we're grabbing those now. So now we're kind of alternating the public domain stuff, like the stuff we used to do on Mystery Science Theater, with the blockbusters. But for the blockbusters, you just kind of get an audio track and you sync it up. Although we now have a couple of players that are working pretty well. They're still in beta, but, you know, where it'll do the work for you if you download it.
Oh, so if you have the DVD, you can put the DVD in your computer and,
right,
and play it through the player, and it will... The technology will synchronize your audio with the movie itself.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's still some bugs, I think, in the Mac version. That's the most ornery.
Yeah, go figure, right? Yeah, everything. There's always an issue with the Mac version, right?
Yes, of course. But I think the PC one is working pretty well now. And the Mac one is working pretty well. You know, like, okay, needs work. But, yeah, so that's a frontier that I kind of like that we've, you know, gotten through, because I have to say, I even though I love doing these and I love that people love them, and we have, you know, very nice obsessive fans who like to kind of roll them together and reauthor them and, you know, set their own sound levels and everything. It's just that OCD thing you get with geekdom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I am not that person, and I just kind of don't even like syncing them up particularly, even though it's actually kind of easy. My wife usually does it. So I really am excited about the whole player thing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is it something that you go through, and this also kind of applies to Mystery Science Theater, though not so much with the show because obviously it was broken up into segments, but with Riff Tracks, you guys go through an entire movie in one take, or are you stopping and going back and kind of recutting things that you may have not liked as much, or, you know, going back and revising a joke or something like that? How spur of the moment is that process?
It's written, and then you know, we have a rehearsal or two where we rewrite a lot, but by the time we get to the recording booth, it doesn't change that much. Every now and then we'll, like, one of us will go, hey, didn't we just do that joke like 20 minutes ago? But for the most part, it's, you know, as close to one take as we can get it,
yeah,
flubs notwithstanding.
So right now on the site, on the Riff Tracks site, which is just rifftracks.com, right?
Yeah.
And that's RIFFTRAX.com. Right now you can download, I think you can get your versions of X-Men The Last Stand. Your jokes about that. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Now, that was like, that's a 3.5-hour movie. You guys did jokes,
yeah,
for 3.5 hours?
Yeah, well, thankfully we didn't use the director's cut.
Yeah, which is 4.5 hours.
Four and change.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's those are challenging. And I, you know, I'm not sure that anybody could reasonably sit through 3.5 hours of us yammering about any movie,
yeah,
but... People have told me they usually split them up to two evenings. Two evenings.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, in a typical episode of Mystery Science Theater, the average was something like 700 jokes in the course of what was very often a B movie, which is rather short. I mean, and then that times three, maybe, or four, is, you know, a Riff Tracks commentary on Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Did you guys do all three movies or just the one?
We have done all of them.
Oh,
and we've done, I think, every goddamn bit of Star Wars and Star Trek there is out there.
And also I noticed the eclipse from the Twilight Saga.
Oh, God, the whole, I think up until New Moon.
Yeah.
And I hate that I know this, but I hate that I know the titles here. But Twilight really took off for us. We were a little tentative about riffing it, and it's as close to a viral success as we've had for some reason.
Oh, wow.
Can't quite explain it. I think it's just so... It's so ripe for it. It's so, it takes itself so seriously, and it's so humorless, and it's also has, technically for us, it leaves a lot of space for jokes, because they're always looking at each other all, you know, moon-eyed.
Right. Right. I've never seen any of those movies, but I think I'm going to get the riff tracks versions of the audio and then go through and watch.
Give it a try.
It's got to be brilliant. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not for grown men as a rule, but, you know, armed with our bullshit, you might be able
well,
to.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what makes it entertaining. Now, I mean, that said, do you guys ever, between you and Mike and Kevin, did one of you ever come up with a movie? We got to do a riff tracks on this particular film, and two of you or one of you goes, you know what, I don't know if I can hold down my lunch while we do that. And do you actually disagree on what movies to do sometimes?
Every now and then, yeah. I mean, we've tried to reframe it that, you know, when we do a movie, we're not necessarily saying this is a horrible movie, although many of them are, and we'll kind of say it if they are. But we've done movies we like. We did the original Jaws, which we're all kind of fans of. I mean, it holds up pretty well, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lord of the Rings, we kind of like it. Actually did something called the Riff Tracks Challenge last year is what we called it. We did like the best movie ever. We did Casablanca.
Oh my
and
God.
And just said, you know, we're not saying that this is a bad movie. We're just going to see if we can make it funny. You know, so it's Kevin Murphy compares it more to like a roast of somebody you like rather than a, you know, the utter destruction of something you hate.
Right, right. Have you ever taken a movie that is inherently, I mean, just really, have you ever done like a serious film? Like, I don't imagine you. No, I don't think there's ever going to be a riff tracks of like Schindler's List. No,
hell no. Yeah, that's the classic example we use. Yeah. It's like, no, of course not.
Right.
You know, Hotel Rwanda. No, no. You know, you'd have to be a monster to make that funny or to like be watching it. Now, I don't know. Theoretically, maybe there's a movie out there about a serious subject that it's so ham-handed and stupid that we could find a way in. But yeah, I mean, it's something that is pretty well done, like Schindler's List or Hotel Rwanda. No.
No.
Be poisonous.
I can imagine so. We're going to come back and talk to a little bit more about Riff Tracks and Mystery Science Theater, and then I want to talk to you about some media stuff.
Sure.
But I got to talk about soap here. I don't know if you ever tried Bubble Genius, but it's the best goddamn soap in the world. It's pure products, pure genius. Bubble Genius at bubblegenius.com. Hilarious, all-natural, eco-friendly products for bath, body, and mental well-being. It's the coolest soap and body care stuff you've ever seen. And plus, they have lots of fun political things, too. Like, you can wash your bathing suit area with Joe Lieberman's head. I mean, in soap form, not his actual head. That would be gross and weird. So, here's the latest commercial from Bubble Genius.
Hi, this is Paula.
And Sarah from Bubble Genius.
Bubble Genius!
We're taking a little vacation,
even though we really are still down in the shop working like crazy.
But we couldn't really think of an ad, but we know, like, Bob needs about a minute to take a pee.
We thought we'd fill up some time for him, because we have stuff to say!
Yeah, so get going, Bob.
Yeah, Bob, take a hike while we talk. Also, we want to say goodbye to our dear lovely Elvis. We've enjoyed listening to you and telling people to
get cancer of the dick hole
and go fuck themselves
and douche, 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 douche.
And we might even miss you being nerdy about movies.
Maybe.
Might.
I don't know. No. Anyway.
But you'll always be on our hearts, dear Elvis. So
yeah, so Elvis has left the building. And we'd like to say thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, and so, by the way, even though we are working, we're trying to be on vacation a little bit every day, so we think we should tell you guys to do the same.
Yeah, take one yourself.
Take a little vacation every day. Have a cookout for lunch. Go for a walk in the park after dinner.
Yeah, don't do something. Leave at 5 o'clock.
Sit home in your bathtub and
use one of our summery soaps.
Even if you're hot, you could use a snowflake soap and pretend like it's winter.
Yeah, it's peppermint anyway. Anything you want to wash with, as long as it's ours.
And happy vacation!
Have a good one.
Peace out. BubbleGenius.com.
Shove Bob and
to be determined
into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go.
Right.
Subscribe to the Bob and
insert name here
show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Yep. There's a new promo code for Bubble Genius. If you go to BubbleGenius.com and you order your favorite soaps, enter the promo code AWESOME, AWESOME. And get 15% off your entire order from BubbleGenius.com. And, you know, if I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times, Bubble Genius, the coolest damn sponsor in the world. I mean, where else are you going to find a sponsor who will do a commercial in which they use the words fuck and the word dickhole? So anyway, so I wanted to get back to a little bit of Mystery Science Theater and Riff Tracks. And I, you know, I don't know if this is something that you're sort of at liberty to talk about, but I'm wondering, in the course of the time that you were there, which network was more aggravating and less funny, Comedy Central, Comedy Central, or Sci-Fi?
I'm pretty at liberty to talk about it since what can they do to me, man? But truthfully, I was a little more front and center under Sci-Fi, so I know that a little better. And I know, you know, I know they had their problems with Comedy Central too, and I was there briefly as a writer under them. But you know, I think under Comedy Central, they did have a couple of really great years of just sort of being left alone and getting their truckload of cash every year. Yeah. And you know, Comedy Central was smart enough not to mess with a good thing. And get in the way. And I don't think they ever, I don't know if it's literally true, but I think they got almost no notes at all. Basically, it was just like, keep going, you know, don't drop the F-bomb, please, because we can't do that. But otherwise, just keep up the good work. During my time at Sci-Fi, somebody had the bright idea of starting to give notes to the show, which was a little bit painful because, you know, especially for the guys who had been there for a while, I mean, They just knew how to do this show and didn't really need notes, didn't need comedy notes. And it just seemed like a make-work project for this one executive. But I think we just sort of stonewalled so often that they gave up and found something else to do.
Right. And so, you know, in the process of doing Riff Tracks, I mean, I don't know how many total movies you guys have produced jokes for, but is there an internal censor that happens? I mean, do you find obviously it's got to be more liberating than working for a basic cable network, mm-hmm. but so is it? Do you have to add an extra layer of, well, you know what? We don't have you know, an executive kind of tempering the show, so should we be a little more diligent in terms of the jokes we write, degree of poisoning that I think Latitude often does to a show. For example, when Howard Stern went to Sirius Satellite Radio, I think it's less. Yeah. I think he's less funny on Sirius, where he can do anything, than he was on FM.
I totally agree.
Where he had to be kind of smart about how he worked his way around standards and practices and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, we've pretty much kept to the model. You know, like we try to basically match the rating of the movie we're in, you know, so we don't get too blue. I mean, we do certainly when we go for a beer afterwards, but as a rule, we try to make it, if not exactly family friendly, that would be a little, you know, cute of me to say, but you know, sort of like PG-13 as a rule. Now here and there, we've had exceptions to that. Kevin and I did a couple on our own. Like, we did the first of the Saw series and we let ourselves get a little, you know, a little naughtier, but for the most part, we try to keep it sort of in that wheelhouse, you know, PG-13.
Yeah. You know, there's also another troupe that's doing, I mean, I think Joel started a troupe called Cinematic Titanic. Is there any sort of rivalry between you guys?
Well, I can't speak for anyone else's mind, but I think it's, if there's anything, there's sort of a friendly rivalry. It's not to say we're all palling around and hanging out together. I mean, it was a pretty big cast, you know, over a multiple, you know, over about 10 years, so a lot of us overlapped, but didn't really hang out together. But it's not, I don't think it's a vicious rivalry, at least on our part, where we kind of do slightly different things. They concentrate a little more on touring and doing live performance, and we're a little more web-based, you know, not exclusively so, but I don't think there's horrible blood between us. It's you know, I'm giving a White House operative answer here, but I know, like, when our fans listen, they read all kinds of shit into this.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a...
All I can say is I like everybody who has ever been involved with the show, and I feel like, from my point of view, we're in pretty good terms.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't mean that you guys are having, like, gang fights, like, out the alley behind the theater. I mean,
believe me, our fans ask us this all the time, because they want to know, and I kind of get why, but... It's just we have two separate operations, and, you know, if there's any rivalry, it's pretty slight.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, but the big difference is you guys are kind of doing – Riff Trax is more focused on more recent films, and I think Cinematic Titanic, which is Joel Hodgson, and I think Trace is working with him, and then
– Frank Conniff.
Right, Frank Conniff and Mary Jo –
Mary Jo Peel and J. Elvis Weinstein.
Right, exactly.
Was the original Servo.
And so they do the silhouettes of them sort of standing in a theater, but they're still doing sort of older films, right?
They are, yeah. And we do those too, but we do them more for like direct to video or downloadable. Right. Or in our occasional live performances, we use those too.
You know, in your experiences dealing with all these films, have you kind of noticed that films kind of suck now? I mean, more so than they used to. I mean, really, the suckiest movies are really, is it now or is it was it the, you know, sort of 30 years ago they just stopped being good? Right around the mid to late 80s, they just stopped, and now they're just generally awful.
I think that's a really viable theory, and I think there's probably really good reasons for that. Among them are that it's just it's more of a business. It's just more of a business. It was always at least somewhat of a business, but now it's kind of doesn't even pretend to be otherwise. And I know there are pockets of indie film and good film. You know, if you seek it out, you can find it. But as far as Hollywood stuff, I don't think you're going to see a real lot of, you won't see much stuff comparable to that time in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, where a lot of mainstream Hollywood movies were also really great movies. You know, mm-hmm. The Godfather, just to use the cliche example.
Are they gearing things more towards... kids, or is it something that is just, I don't know, just like they just don't know what they're doing and they're just flailing?
I think they know what they're doing, or they try to make it a real science in the art of, you know, grabbing as much money as they can. I've worked in Hollywood a little bit. I don't know if you know this, but I wrote an Eddie Murphy movie. It was a pretty shitty movie called Meet Dave,
right?
And it came out a couple of years ago. And what I kind of learned in my experience there was they're going for something called, I think I have this right, the five quadrant or four quadrant movie, where you can get, and they tick this off. My agent ticked this off. It's like, you can get parents, you can get kids, you can get, you know, the foreign market, and you can get, so they have sort of a matrix of a movie that works like that. And the example that was presented to me was A Night at the Museum, which was written by some pretty funny guys, Thomas Lennon and his partner. But I think in the process, what happens, or what happened to me in that experience, is they drain the idiosyncrasies out of it, and they try to make it, you know, appeal to as many common denominators as they can. And so funny jokes become kind of, sort of funny jokes. And I don't know. Yeah. I know everybody in Hollywood bitches about this too, so that's sort of a cliche in itself. But I do think that in their zeal to like get all these markets pinned down at once, it just sort of blands everything out.
Yeah, I think in terms of comedy, the really funny stuff is happening with, you know, kind of a select group of people, sort of the extended Judd Apatow family.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And so if you come in and you don't and you're not part of that group, then you end up kind of getting screwed out of what you originally sold, which sounds to me as if that's what happened to you with Meet Dave. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I hesitate to get too pretentious about this because I had a script that I wrote with a partner of mine who's a Hollywood writer, mostly a TV writer. His name is Rob Greenberg. He wrote on most recently on How I Met Your Mother and Frasier. And it was, I think, a pretty funny script. It was not an act of genius. It was not an act of artistic genius. We thought it was funny, and I think ideally it would have been funny I'm trying to what's the show by the Simpsons guys? I'm totally blanking. Bob.
Futurama.
Thank you. And the best of that. And then little by little, you know, they took it out of our hands and gave it to other writers, and it just got a little blander and stupider. They tried to gear it more towards kids, which made it a little schizophrenic. So a lot of the more R-rated stuff bit the dust.
Right.
And then it was pretty badly directed by one of the nicest guys I've ever met. So you just don't know what to do in a situation like that. And I hesitate to bitch and moan too much because I do, you know, I did get a big payday from it and I'm still getting paid for it. But it did frustrate me about going any further with that world because we took a lot of meetings, we met a lot of people, and, you know, it was basically doing the research and development for any little production company. By writing a treatment, which would be like half a script worth of material practically, to get the job. So they would pitch you against 10 other teams or 10 other writers. So that's what you get at that level until you are at the Judd Apatow level where they just say, all right, you have a sensibility and a brand we like, and, you know, we're going to trust you to kind of do it.
Was the process of making that film and kind of the... the stripping of some of the stuff that you thought was funny and that you had in there originally, was that a really soul-crushing kind of experience?
No, I think it might have been if I was in my 20s, but I was sort of had been down the road a little bit and had come through Mystery Science Theater. I didn't expect much going in and was kind of surprised when it sold, so it didn't really crush my soul. It just sort of made me wonder if I wanted to, you know, go that route any further. And it sort of got answered for me when Riff Tracks came along because we just sort of dedicated ourselves to that.
And so is that something, I mean, you're basically doing Riff Tracks full time now? Is that sort of the
I am.
The
That's changing a little bit. Yeah. You know, we tried to get the business off the ground by doing a ton of work, you know, up front and getting a lot of stuff into the catalog. So it's pretty jammed with titles that you can go and download now, but I think we can afford to slack off a little bit now and do live shows and do some other work too. I know Mike Nelson's got a screenplay he's writing, which I think is about to go into production soon, and so we're trying to balance it out a little more.
And you actually have a live show coming up that's happening on August 17th. You guys are doing the original
Jack the Giant Killer, yeah.
And is this the first time you've done something sort of live that goes out to movie, or is it performed live, or is it something that you record in advance and then it just gets beamed out digitally to all of these theaters?
No, it's actually performed live, and we've done three of these before. We did Plan 9 from Outer Space. We did Reefer Madness. We did four of them before. Excuse me. We did a bunch of weird Christmas shorts. And then we did The House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. And we've had guests for some of them. We had Weird Al Yankovic do the Christmas shorts with us. And Paul F. Tompkins did the House on Haunted Hill with us, sort of guested for us. We go to one theater and we actually do it live in front of an audience. And we usually go to Nashville because that's where the company we work with is located, the production company.
Oh my God.
What's that?
I was kind of shocked by that. Nashville.
It's kind of weird.
They think things are funny in Nashville?
Cognitive dissonance there. No, I mean, it's a pretty fun town. I mean, we go to the hipster student area.
Oh, okay. All right. That makes
Delcor
sense.
Delcor Theater. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then it's beamed, it just sort of simulcasts across, you know, I think it's like 500 theaters around the United States.
It's unbelievable.
It's pretty cool, actually. It's this company that does a lot of stuff like this, and one of their most popular things, weirdly enough, is simulcast opera. And I guess there are just these pockets of opera fans in cities around the country who pay a lot of money to see a production from the Metropolitan Opera. They've also done, I regret to say, Glenn Beck. They did one of his Christmas, you know, tear fests.
That's right. And you know what? I was thinking about this, but I would love to see like a Riff Tracks or MST3K style commentary on Fox News Channel. Like, you know, like Bill O'Reilly and Hannity, just like 2 hours of you guys riffing on those shows. I mean, this is one thing that would be sort of like two worlds colliding for me. I just love to see that and see what you guys would come up with for that. Or even if you took like okay, we're going to take this episode or these two episodes and create a commentary track for it. And this would just be for the political wonks and the nerds on Twitter. And then we'll all just, we'll titter about it and then have a good time about it. And then you can go back to doing the riff tracks about movies.
I'm actually surprised nobody has made a brand like that.
Yeah.
You know, somebody outside of us.
And then do you find yourself sitting at home and then just thinking up jokes about what you're watching and just like, oh, my God.
I do, and then I regret it. Yeah. You know, just like, for fuck's sake, just watch it and shut up. I don't do it too often, but, you know, every now and then my wife will just say, okay, you know, you're off duty now, honey. You can just... She once actually said to me, "All right, would you stop riffing breakfast?" God damn it.
Riffing breakfast. So you're making commentary like this, making jokes about the cereal and the egg.
Yeah,
and,
charming.
Yeah, this juice could be better, you know.
just what people want to hear in the morning.
Right. Well, got to talk about soap here. BubbleGenius.com is the official sponsor of the Bob and Brr show. don't really have a name for it yet, but and we will come up with a name, I promise. Pure products, pure genius at bubblegenius.com. We have a new commercial from Bubble Genius, and here it is.
Hi, this is Paula and Sarah from Bubble Genius.
Bubble Genius!
We're taking a little vacation.
Even though we really are still down in the shop working like crazy.
But we couldn't really think of an ad, but we know like Bob needs about a minute to take a pee.
We thought we'd fill up some time for him because we have stuff to say.
Yeah, so get going, Bob.
Yeah, Bob, take a hike while we talk. Also, we want to say goodbye to our dear lovely Elvis. We've enjoyed listening to you and telling people to
get cancer in the dickhole
and go fuck themselves and
douche.
And we might even miss you being nerdy about movies.
Maybe.
Might.
I don't know. No. Anyway.
But you'll always be on our hearts, dear Elvis. So
yeah, so Elvis has left the building. And we'd like to say thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, and so, by the way, even though we are working, we're trying to be on vacation a little bit every day, so we think we should tell you guys to do the same.
Yeah, take one yourself.
Take a little vacation every day. Have a cookout for lunch. Go for a walk in the park after dinner.
Yeah, don't do something. Leave at 5 o'clock.
Sit home in your bathtub and
use one of our summery soaps.
Even if you're hot, you could use a snowflake soap and pretend like it's winter.
Yeah, it's peppermint anyway. Anything you want to wash with, as long as it's ours.
And happy vacation!
Have a good one.
Peace out. BubbleGenius.com.
Shove Bob and
to be determined
into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go. Subscribe to the Bob and
insert name here
show in the podcast section on iTunes.
See what I did there? I took out the mentions of Elvis and put in insert name here. And again, put in your promo code AWESOW, AWESOW, or I'm strung out. AWESOME. Awesome. And get 15% off your entire order from Bubble Genius. I mean, if you're not buying your soap, you got to support progressive liberal businesses. I mean, there's so few of them out there. When you find one, get all your stuff there. And if I see a Walmart buying soap, I'm going to rip your tongue out by the roots. You son of a bitch. and then you'll have to ask me what I'm doing there at Walmart. Anyway, so the Republicans are always purport themselves to be these tough-talking sort of cowboys, these guys who will routinely criticize the president as being feminine or being, you know, kind of like the phrase they always used to describe the president is he has San Francisco values, or he's, you know, he's like girlish, or they say like when he was, you know, he received advice about Afghanistan from Hillary Clinton, so therefore he's somehow feminine and he's getting, you know, but what happens is that every time the president then gets on television and starts talking about the Republicans and challenging them to actually do their job, that they suddenly scream and cry that he's being a bully. Why exactly are they so thin-skinned? And I have this theory, this ongoing theory, that that it's because the cowboy stuff is horseshit. They're not really these tough guys. They're just it's kind of a facade. Now, this kind of came up with regards to the president's most recent press conference, and then there was a piece in the Daily Caller where they're just really playing up the why is the president being so. So mean to us. It's really not surprising in the slightest that that they're having this reaction, because the president, regardless of what he does or regardless of what he says, he's kind of screwed either way. So if he's actually kind of wanting to compromise, then he's not being a leader. But then when he steps up and is trying to get Congress to do something about the economy, well, then he's being a bully. Ultimately, I don't believe there's anything the president can do to satisfy the Republicans.
You are correct.
And so, yeah, right. So consequently, I'm not sure exactly why, and this leads into the broader question of how does anything get done at this point?
Does the
president actually try to come up with some sort of compromise position with people who he has insisted have driven us into a ditch? Or does he let them go about their own thing, passing their own thing, only to then veto it, and then nothing happens? And so, you know, there's really it's really kind of a tough needle to thread. So the only option left is to compromise. And then the question becomes, how deeply do you compromise? Do you give them 75%? Do you give them 50%? Will they accept 50% of the offer? I don't know. So, you know, I mean, you see what I'm saying, Bill? Is there any option here? Can he come up with anything that will please anyone at this point? Is he just going to perpetually anger the left in the process of trying to appease the right, and vice versa?
Well, I think you described the situation brilliantly. And the weird thing is, we have a microcosm of that situation here in Minnesota, where I live right now. Although things have actually shut to a halt. I mean, as you know, we have the government shutdown, and I don't really have an answer, except that if one party is always saying, you know, do what I want or I'll shoot this kid, you know, yeah, and the other party, you know, tries to find much of what it wants, you know, like try to give it much of what it wants, and they keep saying, I will still shoot this kid, give me more. Mm. I mean, what's the end game there? It's just there's no way out of that situation.
Yeah.
So as far as who to please, I don't really know. I mean, yeah, you do have to compromise, but the other party is not doing that. And at this point, I think that has to be the loud and clear message, is that we cannot compromise. I mean, they will not compromise is really the question.
Well, this is
how to frame that. Smarter people than me probably.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to adequately compromise. I mean, because there is no compromising with the Republicans. They want everything, and anything short of that, they're not going to accept. Now, it's like, you know, they're running, the Republicans are running around with scissors basically for fun and politics. I mean, they're basically playing grab ass with the debt ceiling, and it's highly irresponsible, and I'm still shocked that it's actually a point of contention, that there's actually discussion that we might not raise the debt ceiling, which would be, as we've all heard over and over again, catastrophic. But this is something they're willing to do because I think they understand that the president's in a position where he's got no choice. If he wants to do anything in the next 2 years, he's got to compromise with them. So they have taken the extreme position, forcing him to meet them not halfway, but, you know, giving them, at this point, it appears as if he's going to give them essentially 75% of what they want, which is now pissing people like me off. And, you know, and again, I'm not necessarily blaming the president. I just think he's got no choice. I mean, there's really nothing else he can do. I mean, he can go out and make a case to the American people. He can use the bully pulpit, as everyone's sort of demanding that he does. But I don't know what that actually means. I mean, how far that can actually go, or how long? I mean, how long does that continue?
Or who's going to cover it? You know, for that matter, who's going to make it the lead story in the news? You know,
that's right.
I do think, yeah. I mean, there's one thing that I think he is immensely capable of doing is selling a hard case well. And if he, I don't know, I know people want him to fight harder, and he's just not that guy, and he never will be, and he probably shouldn't be. He's the president. But what he can do is just keep making that case until CNN has to pick it up. That's the one thing I don't see him doing that frustrates me. I'd like to hear less. You know, there's good ideas from all parties here, and we'll try. You know, there aren't. There just aren't at this point.
But I mean, I really feel like, I mean, as the polls are showing that the American people are really already on the side, on the progressive side of things with regards to these specific issues. They want, right. I mean, people by massive supermajority numbers want there to be tax increases on the rich.
Overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, they want Congress to not touch Medicare and Social Security. And so, you know, going out and convincing people on television, and I'm speaking specifically of the president here, he doesn't even need to do that because the American people are already with that side. So, I mean, and yet the Republicans still don't want to compromise. They don't want to even acknowledge that these polls exist. They still are insisting that, well, you know, even like Orrin Hatch, they say, well, even the poor have to sacrifice. Yeah. I mean,
Can you believe Ted Kennedy was ever pals with that guy? It just seems like a monster.
So I don't know that any poll or any amount of convincing of the American people beyond their level of being convinced now. I mean, they're already convinced. We don't need to convince them anymore. And yet,
you only have to look at healthcare to see that. I mean,
that's right.
What was it? 70% of people want some variation on a public option, for lack of a better term, and it didn't happen.
Right.
So. It gets back to the question of who is really making these rules. And I just think there's a whole, I forget who it was, but somebody came up with a theory that there's no benefit to betting against big corporate America now if you're a politician. I mean, some brave politicians do it, and they're all Democrats or third party like Bernie Sanders, but really, you know, if you're a Republican or a blue dog, the thing to do is just keep doing what they want. And even if you lose an election, you've guaranteed a great future for yourself. If you bet against them, if you kind of don't do what they want and lose an election, you're probably fucked. I mean, I know this might be conspiracy theory in some level, grossly oversimplified, but I mean, there's just so much money, you know, shooting around Washington, and so many opportunities to get it while you're elected and after, especially after, that it's the coward's bet, the easy bet, the dumb person's bet is to just do what, you know, the billionaires want.
Yeah. So what amount of convincing would shift Republican votes? Nothing. Because the American people are already with the progressive argument on all of this. So I don't know what – I mean, I don't know what kind, what amount of leadership – this is sort of that ambiguous term, leadership. Like, what amount of leadership can the president present that will actually shift those votes? And I don't think there's anything really that can be done.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's wise to be sort of a short-term pessimist and maybe a long-term optimist if you're a progressive at this point, and get working locally, because I think that's where stuff might be possible and that's where an idea might take root. But Washington, you know, I hate to say write it off as a lost cause because we can't afford to. It affects us too much. But for agents of change, I'd say go as local as you can and, you know, be as direct as you can.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to get things done, because I think you have to, in order to get the votes of some of the conservatives and the Blue Dog Democrats, the only way to shift those votes is to shift a popular opinion on the ground, because they're going to swing. Those people
yes.
are all about swinging whichever direction the wind blows. So, I mean, yeah. are we going to successfully primary Ben Nelson and put in a progressive Democrat in his place? Not a chance in hell.
Because, unlikely, yeah.
Yeah, because there aren't any progressive votes to be had, or at least enough winning progressive votes in Nebraska to do so. So mm-hmm. how do you get those votes? You convince people on the ground. You convince
right.
voters. You go door to door. And that's, you know, that's sort of one of my ongoing rants with regards to the progressive movement. We're not focusing enough on the door-to-door effort as we are with sort of noble yet futile efforts like primarying Blanche Lincoln, which is just, or Joe Lieberman for that matter.
I think that was a noble experiment that failed and now has to not happen again. You know, like.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, and neighbor to neighbor, Bob. I mean, I don't know about you. Like, I live around, I have my family's Republican, a lot of my neighbors are, and there's a lot of common ground there. It's never going to be exactly how we want it, but the one frame everybody seems to agree on is that Washington is a cesspool of corruption, you know. And
right.
if you can wedge that in and go from there, like, you know, gently kind of ask, well, why is that?
Yeah.
Then,
well, I mean,
you have an opening.
I just always feel like, you know, there's measurable reality out there. There's mathematical reality for everything from the budget to healthcare to the debt ceiling and climate change and all of that. And it's just a matter of delivering those facts. And I think when people understand, for example, that the Obama administration reduced the deficit by $122 billion between Bush's last budget and the first Obama budget, then people go, what? I didn't realize that. And you go, yeah, well, that's actually true. And then they go, well, you know, maybe we're wrong. Or maybe Fox News is wrong about what they say about record deficits and it's all Obama's fault. It's really not. But, you know, so that's, I mean, it's just the, like, little things that we can deliver along the way that will actually convince people that maybe that's the right way to go. But anyway, Bill, thank you so much for joining us, joining us, because I'm used to another guy being on the show, joining me on the show this
Phantom
week.
Elvis.
Riff Tracks Live on August 17th. It is the original Jack the Giant Killer. And check your theater listings to see if it's happening in your area. And, of course, go to rifftracks.com and download the funniest damn stuff since Mystery Science Theater. Bill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob. What a pleasure.
Take care. We'll see you on Twitter. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.